You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, May 26, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor of English at CUNY, New York City, Ashley Dawson, on Extinction, A Radical History. Also on the program today, Bernie Sanders within 2 points in California. And will it be Sanders v. Trump on the debate stage, ladies and gentlemen? Meanwhile, the State Department Inspector General report on the Clinton emails released. South Carolina bill signed to ban abortions after 19 weeks. And speaking of the relevance of the Supreme Court, whoopsie-daisy, Orrin Hatch's op-ed discussing why, even after meeting Merrick Garland, he cannot support Merrick Garland, is published before he meets Merrick Garland by mistake.
It makes the article even more accurate in an odd way. It's indeed. Like, I really can't.
No. Meanwhile, Ohio can't stop trying to find new ways to suppress the vote. And 11 states sue the Obama administration for being reminded that it's against the law to discriminate against kids who are transgender. All that and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, it's fascinating right now. Donald Trump last night was on, I guess, Jimmy Kimmel's show. And Donald Trump said, I'll debate Bernie Sanders. And within, I don't know, what did it take? About 30 seconds. I don't know how long it was. Bernie Sanders tweeted, game on. I'll do it. Let's do it before the California primary. With that said, Donald Trump then supposedly put out through his spokespeople that he was just joking.
Bernie's been unfair to me.
Bernie's being very, very, like, forward.
just too aggressive.
Too forward. We'll play those sounds later in the program. And I want to juxtapose that, of course, with Bill O'Reilly. Just saying on Monday that Hillary should debate Bernie to defend capitalism. Well, who better to defend capitalism than Donald Trump? I don't know. Maybe we'll hear O'Reilly say that. O'Reilly's going to be sitting around going, oh, Jesus. How am I going to? Oh, I know how I'm going to do it. I'm going to completely going to ignore it. That's what he's probably saying. But I don't know if Donald Trump is too afraid of Bernie Sanders, debating Bernie Sanders. What's he going to do when it comes to Putin? I mean, how's he going to, I don't know how he's going to stand up to Putin. That's the problem. Let's play this clip very quickly. My old friend, Mike Stark, of Calling All Wingnuts. You'll recall Mike Stark back in the day used to call up Hannity and Limbaugh's program on a regular basis and harass them. And really not so much harass is the wrong word, actually. Just sort of out-argue them. But I guess Mike didn't have time for that. So he just wanted to get on. And just so you have a little bit of context here, Every time Rush Limbaugh has ever signed a contract in the past, there has been a huge trumpeting of it. And Mike Stark knows this because he was listening to talk radio for years. I mean, you couldn't stop reading about it. They almost had to hire new publicists. Like entire organizations just to report on Rush Limbaugh's contract. Well, you'll recall that following the Rush Limbaugh viciously attacking Sandra Fluck because she was testifying in front of Congress supporting contraceptive care for women, Rush Limbaugh was subject to the Flush Rush program where, and I, forgive me, I cannot remember his name. I think he works for Media Matters now. I'm not 100% sure. But a guy basically started this on Twitter, where he would contact advertisers and say, like, are you aware what you're supporting? And it ended up hurting, I think, talk radio, broadly speaking. But so what? I don't care about that, frankly. And I mean, even if I was on talk radio, tough nuts. Anything that would make it less lucrative for Rush Limbaugh to poison the country, I think, is healthy. So here's Limbaugh. He's caught. He doesn't even know how to respond to this when this gets thrown out there. This is clip number two.
There are people. Mike in Washington, D.C. Let's get started on the phones here. Great to have you with us, sir. Hello.
Hi, Russ. Just 1 second, please. You caught me in the library. I didn't think you were going to get this hour. Okay, I'm good. I'm outside. Sorry. I apologize. I wanted to say that I'm reminded so much of the 90s after this IG report. You know, there are a lot of good reasons people wouldn't want to cooperate that have nothing to do with guilt or innocence. Look at all the people in the 90s that were bankrupted over legal fees. The cheapest way to avoid that is to say nothing to the prosecutors. They don't tell you what they're investigating. You know, knowledge of
all right,
the,
pause it for 1 second. So what Mike Stark is arguing here is that in the IG report that came out, the Hillary Clinton did not agree to an interview with the State Department IG. Now, this is distinct from the FBI investigation, and they are talking to the FBI. But there was a lot of precedent for what Mike Stark is saying. I mean, if I was an attorney and my client said, should I talk to these people? And I would say, well, it's not necessary, so don't. Because I don't know if people remember Ken Starr at all, but by the time they're done, they could have charged Clinton with, I don't know, serving the wrong food from the caterer at Chelsea's wedding or something. So, but that's what Mike is referring to.
There's no excuse. The cheapest thing to do is just say nothing. I mean, this is kind of like you not announcing the price of your next contract is a tacit admission that Flush Rush got you bad, man.
I gather what you're talking about here is the back to the Clinton scandals in the 90s and the Victor, I guess you're talking about tort reform somewhere in there, but
tort reform.
Again, here's the point about this.
Let me tell you what's going on here, because I've been in this situation where I when I was on talk radio, on AM talk radio, I wasn't so afraid of the audience as Limbaugh is. I mean, they are very, very tough with their screening. And he knows. Limbaugh, right at this moment, they will stop the tape. He knows it was Mike Stark. Because we've played tapes in the past where he gets very angry. And he gets very angry at his call screeners. Because they let Mike through. And he's now trying to throw out at tort reform. He's just looking around like literally this is like, what is it, the usual suspects, right? Like where
free associate.
Kaiser Sose, and he's just looking around going, IO Doc, and Asus, and he's just looking around going, Mini, Mac Mini.
Definitely did not do as good a job as Kaiser Sose.
No, he's just looking around, just going like, coffee maker.
He's sort of like the cop, actually, putting it together at the end.
Yeah, exactly. So he's sputtering around. Watch where he goes with this.
Scandals in the 90s and the drip, drip, drip. I guess you're talking about tort reform somewhere in there. But again, here's the point about this is, and I've got the audio sound bites coming up. Whenever anybody, it was CNN, some guests wanted to talk about Clinton in the 90s and all of the women. The CNN hosts and hostess just shut it down, and they got mad about it.
So there you have it. Limbaugh is just, he is and seething with anger, and he recovers. So good for him. But that's the great Mike Stark. Check him out on Twitter. We'll put his link up. I don't know what his link is, but just give him a kudos because he's cracked the code, ladies and gentlemen. Folks, before we go, I should also tell you that I heard from... Well, I got two compliments over the past 24 hours. One is from my producer on Ring of Fire Radio. We do some videos for Ring of Fire Radio, and he spoke to me this morning, and he said, "What's going on? Are you going to a spa?" I swear to God, he said this to me. And I said,
"Shocking.
Are you mocking me?" And he said, "No. You look so clean-shaven these days." And I said, I don't know what you're really talking about. And I don't know if it's my haircut or what, but it is true. I am clean shaven these days. In fact, he wasn't the only one to compliment. I got a text last night. I was on Hayes, and Louis C.K. Texted me and said that my makeup looked good. And that is also a function of my shaving. I'm not sure what he meant by that, but...
And he knows makeup.
Oh, my God. People don't know this about him, but he's an amateur cosmetologist, if that's a word. And it is true. The reason why I looked so clean shaven, it's because of Harry's.com. That's right. Harry's.com is, and you know this, folks, I've been using Harry's now for an extended period of time. I don't know. Like, I feel like 2 years. 5 German-crafted blades, a flex hinge, which is why you rarely see me wearing toilet paper on my face, and a lubricating strip. It's quality guaranteed. Full refund if you're not happy. Factory direct prices, the middleman, cut out. Bye-bye. No upcharges. Half the price of the crappy things you get in the stores. And, like... I don't know. I haven't done a test, but multiple times the quality of other shavers. Matt, you know this, right? Because you used to use a different type of shaver that you got through the mail.
Yes, I agree.
It's not even you agree. That's where I know that from, because I never used that other razor.
It's the opposite of your MeUndies experience on the razor. You caught the opposite wave of the trend.
Harry's is the MeUndies of razors.
Harry's is the MeUndies. It's a spa in a package.
Harry's starter is just $15. That includes the razor, 3 blades, and your choice of Harry's shave cream or foaming gel.
I
use the non-foaming one. Which one is that? The shave cream. As an added bonus, you get $5 off your first purchase with my code MajorityReport. Majority Report, you know that it's the name of the show. After using my code, you get the entire month's worth of shaving for just $10. What? Are you kidding? Is this a mistake? No, I know it's not because I've read this before. Harry Starter Set, called the Truman, is a great option for new customers, an amazing deal. $5 off your first purchase with that promo code Majority Report. Go to harrys.com right now. Look for the Truman Set. That's Harry's, HARRYS.com. Enter code Majority Report at checkout. Get $5 off. Help support the show. Give yourself a better shave. It's Father's Day. It's a great gift. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Ashley Dawson about his book, Extinction, A Radical History.
Market Square. So many mothers dying. News had just come over. We had 5 years left crying. News guy wept and told us Earth was really dying. Cried so much his face was wet. Then I knew he was not lying. I heard telephones, opera house, favorite melody.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Ashley Dawson. He is a professor of English at the City University of New York and author. His most recent is Extinction, A Radical History. Welcome to the program, Ashley.
Thank you so much, Sam. I'm really happy to be speaking with you.
So let's start with just, I think people have an awareness of this, but this idea of, or not idea, I guess, this reality of 6 great extinctions. Just give us a sense of the history, the sort of, I guess, the very generic history of extinction in terms of our planet.
Okay, well, I think the important thing for people to understand is that extinction is happening all the time. You know, species are continually being snuffed out. But something called speciation is also happening. In other words, new species are evolving. And of course, Darwin talked about this. We've known about this for a long time. What is new is that the rate of extinction has ticked up so much that it's massively overwhelming the rate of new species evolution, so that we're really in the 6th great crisis in the history of the planet in terms of a mass extinction event.
It would give us a sense of what the other 5 were.
Well, probably the one that folks are most aware of was when an asteroid came down out of outer space and struck Earth in what is now the area around the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico and kicked up a huge cloud of dust which surrounded the planet and drove the dinosaurs to extinction. That's the most famous one, but there have been a number of other extinction events in the history of the planet. This one, though, human beings are largely responsible for. And as I argue in my book, it's not just human beings in general. It's the global 1% and the capitalist system that's really responsible for what's happening at the moment.
So, I mean, so can you put in the context, I guess, the size of what makes this 6th extinction that much more critical, I guess, than the other 5, is that it's simply that this is not a specific cataclysmic event, and that what we're seeing is a shift in the balance between the creation or the evolution of new species. I mean, is that the primary sort of why this one is particularly problematic?
Yeah, well, look, you know, life will probably survive on Earth. There will be new species that evolve. The point is, from the perspective of the current species on the planet, including human beings, what we're currently experiencing is this horrible event and a kind of cataclysmic destruction of biodiversity on the planet with only a few precedents. And so, you know, we can't put ourselves inside the perspective of dinosaurs. No doubt that great extinction event mattered a lot to the dinosaurs, but
right,
of course, you know, it's kind of lost to time. The point is, we're in the middle of this current one and we're causing it. And I think that the idea of a mass extinction event is really important to think about in the present historical moment, because some of the other terms we have to cope with what is happening now, like climate change or global warming, I don't really think are alarming enough. You know, I mean, in January in New York City, people hear climate change or global warming and they're like, oh, I could use a bit of that. That's not so bad, right? Whereas
right.
if you think about what's happening on the planet right now as a mass extinction event, then I think we get a kind of suitable sense of alarm and political urgency to really cope with what's happening. And of course, extinction is caught up with other aspects of what gets called climate change. You know, climate change is being caused by carbon we put in the atmosphere, which isn't absorbed back into the atmosphere, back into the earth. And one reason that's not happening is because habitat, like jungles, are being cut down. And of course, those jungles are where the vast majority of biodiversity on the planet is located. So the extinction of species is very much caught up to all of the other major environmental challenges and catastrophes that are unwinding at the moment.
Is there a cause and effect relationship that goes the other way as well? I mean, this is sort of a feedback loop as climate change becomes more problematic, we lose more species. Is that how much of climate change is driving that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's a really good point to make, that there are connections between these different crises and there are feedback effects. So climate change is still responsible for a relatively small percentage of extinction. For instance, about a week and a half ago, the Royal Botanic Society, located in Kew Garden in England, released the first State of the World's Planets report. And this really gives you a sense of like how we're trying to catch up here. We're just sort of doing a global assessment of plant life on the planet. What they said in that report was that climate change is, at the moment, responsible for somewhere around 4 or 5% of the extinction of plants on the planet, and habitat destruction is responsible for about 10 times as much destruction of plant life. But of course, that's changing. And the more climate change kicks in and the more the feedback mechanisms within climate change itself begin to take effect, then the more magnified the contribution of climate change to the extinction of plants and animals on the planet is going to be. So, these different aspects are very much connected, and that connection is going to get more and more apparent all the time.
I want to circle back to the idea of your idea that perhaps species extinction creates a greater sense of urgency than the notion of climate change. Now, but let me ask you, in terms of how you see the crisis, I mean, is there, are these parallel crises? I mean, we're talking about the relationship between them, but I mean, which one, is extinction of species a greater concern? Is that concern an existential one from the perspective of humans, or is it a moral one?
I think it's both of those things. I think that in purely utilitarian terms, we depend on plant and animal life on the planet in order to survive. I mean, you can talk about, for instance, discovery of new plants, potentially giving us new cancer-fighting drugs, that kind of thing. But there's a much more basic way in which we depend on the rest of the life forms that inhabit the planet. I mean, think about the fact that the Amazon rainforest absorbs a huge amount of carbon all the time, that the oceans, for instance, are responsible for the lion's share of absorption of carbon on the planet. And what we're doing by putting so much carbon into circulation, in the case of the oceans, for instance, is that we're acidifying the oceans, right? The pH balance of the oceans is actually being changed by industrial capitalism. And that is very, very bad. At a certain point, they're not going to be able to absorb much more carbon. But in the meantime, what's happening is that the increasing acidic character of the oceans is making it harder for animals that need to be able to form shells to do that, right? I mean, literally, the acidic quality of the ocean is eating the shells away. And that's not just of things like clams and oysters, and it's getting harder and harder to find oysters. I don't know if you and your listeners have become aware of that, but there are kind of crises in oyster producing markets at the moment. But really at the bottom of the food chain, in some of the very small life forms in the ocean that much bigger life forms like whales rely on, are all of these shell-forming creatures, and their populations are beginning to crash. So I think that's one example of how this is a crisis which is really, really very existential, and where these different aspects are wrapped up. And then, as you said, it's also a moral crisis, because on some level, we have responsibility at this point, since we're the capitalist system that's driving us over this precipice is extinguishing so much life. We really have a responsibility to the rest of that life forms, and also to the frontline peoples who depend on that life. And I think that's an important point to remember, that while the extinction crisis might seem to people in the global north, you know, in the rich countries, the industrialized countries of the global north, as something that seems kind of rarefied and not connected to their everyday lives, for people who depend on nature in a much more immediate fashion, which is the majority of people on the planet, people of the global south, you know, this crisis is really very immediate and very existential. And we owe them, our fellow human beings, just as much of a moral debt as we owe the other creatures of the planet.
And presumably, right, these crises that take place, even though they may be in a different hemisphere, they don't necessarily stay localized.
No, absolutely not at all. I mean, this is a global crisis. And in my book, what I try to do is explain how there have been extinction crises in the past. I mean, for instance, I talk about the fact that the Roman Empire really wiped out a lot of the biodiversity in the area around the Mediterranean, where it conquered land and peoples. And I talk about, for instance, the Colosseum and the Circus Maximus and the huge destruction of animal life that took place there as part of the kind of bread and circuses ideological element that kept the Roman rulers, their power legitimate. So there have been localized crises and crashes linked to the destruction of species in the past. But right now, we have a kind of global system which is driving the whole planet to a point of crisis. And that's what really distinguishes what's been happening over the last 500 years from the crises in the relatively recent past that human beings have been involved with.
Break down for us this crisis that has been building over the past 500 years. What have been the distinct, or to the extent there are distinct waves, or the distinct means in which this crisis has been driven, right? And because it's not, obviously, if we're talking about 500 years, we're not just talking about industrial capitalism.
Right. I think that's important to keep in mind. There are lots of debates about when this period called the Anthropocene actually began, the idea that we're living in a new epoch of geological time. And some geologists want to say it begins with the invention of the steam engine. And I and other critics want to challenge that idea. And I think looking at extinction is one really useful way of doing that. So you can go back to the period of European expansion, you know, the arrival of Europeans in the so-called New World, with Columbus and the conquistadors and then other European groups beginning to conquer land and peoples in the New World. And there was a kind of unconscious wave of extinction that took place. You know, Europeans brought with them animal species and viruses and all other kinds of life forms that the New World was not habituated to. And so, for instance, many Native American groups were destroyed, and there were really high rates of mortality when they came into contact with Europeans because they were not immune to influenza and venereal disease and other diseases which the Europeans brought with them. So there's a kind of unconscious wave of extinction that took place during that period of settler colonialism. But then, of course, there were conscious strategies of conquest and destruction, which the European colonials engaged in. And so I also talk, for instance, about the effort to drive bison to the brink of extinction in the Great Plains by Europeans in the 19th century. And that was because the colonizers realized that the Native Americans, the Plains Indians, had a kind of link to the bison that allowed them to remain outside the colonial sphere and to remain outside a kind of capitalist system. And that if they were going to be subdued, then one really efficient way to do that was to destroy as many of the bison as possible. And millions of bison were killed every year in the late 19th century in order to bring the Native Americans to their knees and subjugate them.
And so then, I mean, if we move forward in time and we get to the Industrial Revolution, it's the commodification of both, I guess, flora and fauna that becomes the means in which we accelerate this extinction.
Right, absolutely. So, you know, I want to say that that's happening from the outset of the arrival of the capitalist system and its expansion into the New World and other areas. So, I mean, I talk about the expansion of Russia eastward in order to get furs in Siberia. And so that was a kind of mercantile capitalist phase. But you're completely right that, you know, as capitalism shifted into an industrial phase, the tide of destruction of species really expanded. And in the book, I talk about whaling as an example of that, and the way that the whaling industry was highly industrialized in the 19th century with big steam-powered ships that roved around the world with highly organized crews and hunted whales to the point where it was no longer economically profitable to continue the industry. And so it largely crashes by the early 20th century just based on its lack of economic sustainability as an industry. And I think that's important to kind of remember, because my argument is that capitalism is the system which is unique from previous worlds and economic systems in that it's based on ceaseless expansion on a finite resource base, and individual capitalists have to compete in order to survive. So you get this system that can't rein itself in. It can't do the rational thing, which, to go back to the example of whaling, would be to limit the number of whales that you're harvesting so that, you know, the whales can reproduce and you'll have more whales to go after next year. Capitalism just couldn't do that. The whales were basically driven to the point where there weren't enough of them in the ocean anymore to be economically viable as an industry.
And this dynamic is playing itself out both in sort of specific industries, but also just sort of broadly speaking, right? I mean, that's the story of climate change in some respects, isn't it? Like, we have a limited amount of CO2 that we can absorb as a planet, and we are simultaneously sort of diminishing the capacity for the planet to absorb this by means that you've touched upon, and we're diminishing the capacity of the planet to absorb it because we're simply producing too much of it in chasing after whatever that energy is being used towards, and we're diminishing it because there's a sort of that feedback loop effect where the more we do, the less, you know, the more quickly we deplete those resources which diminish it. I mean, that's the macro and the micro story.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, if we take the case of whaling, it's a good example, although, you know, it's just one example that I give, but it brings up the more general point that you just made. I mean, whaling fleets were organized along national lines, right? The Dutch were competing with the Americans, who were competing with another nation state. So the point is that capitalism organizes itself in terms of competing nation states, and just like individual capitalists have to produce as much as possible in order to survive, well, capitalism creates this incredibly violent competitive world system, and we know from the history of the 20th century that that competition can lead to great destruction of human life as well as to destruction of the natural world. And I think that you're right. In terms of negotiations, trying to reach a viable accord to deal with spiraling emissions of carbon, we see precisely the same thing. You know, the U.S. refusing to step back its emissions because it's afraid that China is going to get a leg up because it's going to be able to develop economically by producing more and more. And the Chinese saying, well, look, but if you look at our per capita emissions rate, since we're much more people and we haven't emitted as much historically, our per capita emissions are much less. And so, yeah, it creates this really competitive world. But what I think it's really important to remember is that it's the developed countries who bear the historical responsibility for a lot of this destruction, and it's the 1% who most of all bear this responsibility and who've profited from all of this. Because the point of my book is to really give people a sense of hope and possibility. I mean, discussing extinction can seem completely dispiriting and apocalyptic, but the idea is to understand that this is a product of a specific system and that we can, if we want, change that system. It's not as if it's something that's hardwired into human consciousness.
This is your critique of Elizabeth Colbert's book in that sense, in that it makes it seem as if there was a sort of a fait accompli quality to these extinctions.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, Elizabeth Colbert's book is wonderful in many ways and gives us an overview of the crisis in various different points around the planet, but I think it's really actually a very incapacitating and hopeless book because it tries to spread responsibility evenly across all of humanity. And there was a sentence in her final chapter that really made me really worried, where she says, you know, if you want to think about the origins or the responsibility for the extinction crisis, you have to talk about someone with a machete in the Amazon or someone on the African savannah with an AK-47 or you, dear reader, sitting with this book in your lap. And I guess I feel that while it's important to make people in the developed world aware of their culpability for what's going on, you know, and make them think, well, should I really buy that hardwood from, you know, the Amazon for my floor or for my furniture, and to think about being responsible consumers. The point is that responsibility is not spread evenly, and that this is a system which has benefited the few disproportionately, both in terms of the last 500 years and then also in the present moment. And I think by doing that, we can really begin to build the solidarity to oppose what's happening and to make some kind of meaningful transformation. And that's really important. You know, and I really fault Elizabeth Colbert, not just for what she said in her book on extinction, but also for her exchange with Naomi Klein. I don't know if you remember what she said in her critique of Naomi Klein's latest book, This Changes Everything. But she just basically says, look, human beings are inherently driven to consume. And if you're trying to shift things so that people don't consume as much, well, you're just barking up the wrong tree and it's impossible. So I think that's a really hopeless argument. And it's, of course, just not historically accurate. Americans on per capita are responsible for 20 times as much greenhouse gas emissions as the average person in a developing country, and much more per capita than a person in a European country, where people arguably live just as well, if not even more well, because they have supporting social networks. So I think it's very important to be critical of that kind of attitude.
I want to talk about the anti-extinction attempts and the rewilding, if we can. But before we get there, what tree did Elizabeth Colbert suggest? I mean, I'm curious. Are there other trees she has in mind, or is it just sort of like you might as well not bark, just lie down underneath the tree and rest?
No. She doesn't. I mean, I was the one who brought up the example of the tree. Her sentence. I'll see if I can find it so I can quote it exactly. But her sentence basically says, you know, the person with the AK-47 and the person with the machete, and you, dear reader, sitting with this book in your lap. And I mean, I guess a book is based on trees on some level, but she doesn't even go into the politics of the consumption. It's linked to this idea that human beings just sort of innately are destructive of the environment, as if it's something in our brains that constantly wants to grow and expand. And she mentions language, for instance, and the way that language lets us think about things. But I think it's based on a really fundamental misunderstanding of history, and one that's too linked to this kind of Malthusian argument that Garrick Hardin makes about the commons, where there's this argument that people who managed ecosystems communally there would be an individual incentive to consume as much as possible. In other words, to like let your cow graze down the grass so that your cow would get fat and, you know, screw everybody else. But if you look at the way that traditional commons dwelling people organize themselves, they have social mechanisms to stop that kind of abusive individual behavior. Right. And so the argument that there's something inherent about us that leads us to engage in that kind of destruction of the environmental commons is one that's really flawed. Garrick Hardin made that in the late 60s, and it was part of a kind of Malthusian argument that's been taken up very much in sort of neoliberal ideas that we just need to commodify the environment, right? If we put a price on nature, then the market will fix things, so we stop consuming. And I have a whole critique in the book of these kind of green capitalist solutions to extinction.
And of course, too, the neoliberal solution would be, and in the event that we run out of food or ecosystems, we can just sort of, by that point, we'll be able to sort of synthetically create them. And that'll be a whole new industry as well.
Absolutely.
I mean, let's talk about these anti-extinction policies that you get into, because I find these pretty interesting, and particularly and as well as the rewilding. I mean, I recall the controversy about the wolves. But let's start with anti-extinction. What is that? What do those policies mean?
Okay, so the idea of de-extinction or anti-extinction is to use cutting-edge genetic engineering technologies to bring back extinct species. And there's been a lot of press attention, media attention to this, particularly to the idea of resurrecting the woolly mammoth or the passenger pigeon. And organizations like Revive and Restore are really trying to do this and to develop the technology to use genetic engineering technologies like CRISPR to wind time backwards and bring these species back. But what I argue is that we need to think about this in the context of a whole shift towards what I call biocapitalism. In other words, a whole new regime of accumulation based on commodifying the genome. And I give a kind of short history of how this has been happening, so that corporations like Monsanto, ever since the 1980s, have been developing genetically modified organisms, you know, things like Roundup, which is very resistant to pesticides, so that farmers can dump a bunch of pesticide on their fields, and with this genetically engineered crop, be able to have the crop have less pests attacking it. And so, you know, it means a whole lot more money for Monsanto, which hadn't been making as much money because previously it was marketing its products to countries in the global south. They developed the capacity to produce pesticides and fertilizers with traditional kind of chemical engineering technology. So there's this big shift going on ever since the 80s into genetic engineering. And that shift is really picking up pace with new technologies. And of course, the real money-making potential lies in genetically engineering human beings. And this may sound like science fiction, you know, it's something out of a Margaret Atwood novel, but it's really not. People are already toying around with the possibilities of doing this. And it brings up real ethical and, I think, social justice concerns. I mean, we already live in a world of really stark inequality. What is it going to mean when the 1% are able to change the hair color and eye color of their children or cure their children's disease, potential future diseases, while the rest of humanity struggles to survive? It's really alarming. And these kinds of political and ethical questions really haven't been dealt with at all at the moment.
I mean, I wonder if it's actually going to be like hair color, or I mean, I think disease would be certainly one that there would be. I mean, you know, the idea of for a couple $100,000, we can guarantee that your kids will not have a disease. But it would also probably, I imagine, go to, like, they're going to be tall. They're going to be very good looking, and they're going to have very high aptitude. So you're going to have all the makings of maintaining, you know, your wealth and your new aristocracy there. Tell us about rewilding. Yeah. This is an idea that came from Monbiot, British columnist.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Well, you know, it's something that conservation biologists in general have been talking about. So Monbiot isn't alone in thinking these issues through. The idea of rewilding is based on the idea that keystone species, like the wolves, which you mentioned previously, have a really important impact on the ecosystems that they're a part of. So in the case of wolves, they hunt big herbivores like moose, for instance. And by diminishing the number of moose in a place like Yellowstone Park, they allow more trees to come back, which leads to more bird life. And so there's what scientists call a trophic cascade. In other words, all the way down the food chain, more biodiversity results once you introduce these keystone species again. And by doing that, you allow ecosystems that have been really transformed by the destruction of these keystone species like the wolf to reassume the biodiversity that they had before those species became extinct. And the wolf is an important case, right? Because why did the wolf go extinct in places like Yellowstone? Well, it wasn't through some natural process. It was going back to some of the things that we talked about previously. It was because white European settlers didn't want wolves preying on their cattle as they were expanding westward.
Right.
So they basically systematically wiped out the wolves. Reintroducing the wolves can bring those ecosystems back to a kind of state of biodiversity that they existed previously. I have a number of criticisms of this. I mean, one has to do with how we imagine wilderness. And all too often we imagine wilderness as if it's some untouched space, right? And that's a very racist perception, right? You know, the ecosystems that are being rewilded today in North America were ones that were kept in their state through the intervention of Native Americans. So that kind of idea that we're turning time back to a period before humanity sort of destroyed the ecosystems is very, very problematic and just repeats some of the kind of genocidal tendencies, although on a more sort of ideological level, which were part of settler colonialism in the first place. And the other major criticism I have of rewilding, even though I think it can do good things, and I don't want to come across as just a complete naysayer in response to all of these new attempts to deal with extinction, but my other criticism of it is that the rewilding that's being discussed at present is rewilding in North America and Europe, largely. And so while we're trying to spend a lot of money and put a lot of attention on bringing back ecosystems in rich countries, deforestation and habitat destruction continues and in many cases is really picking up speed in parts of the global south. Take, for instance, what's happening in Brazil, right? I mean, the Workers' Party government has just been deposed and the new Minister of Agriculture is a soy baron who has been responsible for kind of clear-cutting big swaths of the Amazon rainforest. So, there are really dangerous tendencies afoot, and in many cases, the United States is linked to these tendencies towards habitat destruction, either overtly or covertly.
Mm. All right. Well, so lastly, let me just return to this, I mean, how do you imagine that people are going to get, I mean, to the extent that this is, that the answer is to dealing with this issue is to fundamentally, I think, at least in the context of this country anyways, and certainly in terms of the West, and perhaps even, basically broadly speaking, the Northern Hemisphere, I guess, is to sort of change our perspective, you know, to make a radical change in the way that we perceive, in many respects, our purpose, or, you know, and to, at the very least, change that dynamic. I mean, like you say, we've always had this dynamic where we have basically two competing forces. And at different times it gets out of balance, and it's gotten increasingly out of balance, you know, over the past, let's say, 75 years, you know, or since the industrial age. But it has been increasingly so over the past 400 or 500 years. I mean, how is it that we're going to respond to this, which is a threat that... you know, I don't know. I guess I just sort of perceive climate change as a greater threat. And I see in that regard, you know, the solutions are very similar, right? That I see just a real slow, you know, very little adoption of sort of both the prognosis and the diagnosis and the prognosis. I mean, so where's this coming from?
Yeah, no, that's a very fair question. Look, I would say that capitalism is in crisis right now. It has been since 2008. And as often happens in moments of crisis, there's a lot of ferment, and the outcome might be quite reactionary. In fact, I just mentioned Brazil, but we're seeing a real shift rightward in much of South America, which had some of the most progressive governments on the planet. So we're not guaranteed that all of this is going to end well, either in the short or the long term. But I would say that nonetheless, there is a huge ideological and material crisis of capitalism right now. I mean, ever since 2008, we've been going through this. And that the environmental movement is part of some very vibrant social movements right now. I think that you're right that the first order of business is really to deal with carbon emissions. And I think part of the vibrancy of the environmental movement today in the global north is in the fossil fuel divestment movement. I would push that movement further. In my book, I argue that what we should do is nationalize the big fossil fuel companies. You know, companies like Exxon, we know, have been complicit with lying about the crisis of the environment. And we also know that we can't continue to remove fossil fuels from the ground and burn them. So we need to be much more radical in the calls we're making. And we need to use all of the money which these companies have gained in order to help us make this huge shift into sustainable societies around the world. But I would say that the extinction crisis is really part of that. And remember some of the things I said earlier about how habitat destruction is very, very much caught up with the crisis of climate change. Remember that forests absorb really significant amounts of carbon. And so I think the point is to connect these various struggles, you know, to see that struggles against extinction are linked to struggles to divest from fossil fuels and move to sustainable forms of energy generation, and also to connect people across geographical distance, right? To connect indigenous people in the Amazon who are fighting against deforestation and big dams, which are also generating too much carbon, to people in the global north in places like the Bronx, where, you know, people are being victimized by too much emissions of toxic gases and waste and other things like that.
Right.
To see these kinds of links. Yeah, so I think we're at a really perilous but also quite exciting moment of pushback and transformation.
Ashley Dawson, the book is Extinction, A Radical History. We have a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Appreciate it.
It's been great talking to you, Sam. Thanks for having me on.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks. Going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. Just a reminder, it is your... it is your membership that makes this show possible. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. jointhemajorityreport.com. All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. Don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Don't forget, majorityreportkickback.com. Buy your stuff at jet.com through that link, or amazon.com through that link. Bookmark those links. Always buy your Jet or Amazon stuff through that link. We get a kickback. Tomorrow on the program, Cliff Schechter on vacation. Digby will be joining us. And then, to save America once more, Andy Kindler. We'll be right back after this.